Thank you for your invitation, Azaf. I'm very glad to be there. So I'm going to talk about others' gaze in human cognition. And I will start with a very general introduction. So since works run in the 70s, it is well known that nonverbal social cues, that social interaction, rely mainly on the decoding of nonverbal social cues that participate to the paralinguistic functions of communication by organizing and structuring social interaction. I mainly study how these nonverbal social cues, such as gaze directions, emotional expressions, or gestures, postures, influence implicitly human behavior, cognition, or even metacognition. And I regularly used the techniques from cognitive neuroscience to elucidate the brain mechanism underlying these influences. So, for example, functional magnetic resonance imagery, electroencephalography, but also peripheral responses of the system, such as the skin conductance response. A majority of my work focuses on the processing of others' gaze direction. This is a very interesting stimulus because at the visual level, it is very simple, but it involves complex mechanisms related to social cognition. And in particular, gaze processing are theorized to underpin the development of human social aptitudes. This has been supported by data from phylogenetics and ontogenesis. Sorry, and I'm going to illustrate this data very rapidly. So, from the phylogenetic viewpoint, the morphology of the eyes would have evolved so that the eye regions would have become the main informative regions in the human body. This has been supported by these two author firsts here. And in this study, they observed the morphology of the eyes of 88 species of primates, which represent around half of the species that have been listed today. And they determined that the eyes may present two types of silency. The silency of the eye outline as compared to the whole face, here, and the silency of the iris as compared to the sclera. And they show that the majority of species do not possess any of these silences, so that the eye direction is very difficult to determine in these species. Some of the species possess one, here are the other of the silency. However, the human eyes is the only morphology of which possesses two types of silency, so that the eye direction is very easy to discriminate. And so the eye regions, through evolution, would have become the main source of information. And this is supported by the studies run using eye tracking in humans, showing robustly that when we process faces, the eye region is the first and the most explored region of the face, just before the mouth. So, this triangular pattern of exploration is very robust and have been reproduced whenever the face is presenting is drawn, is photographed, or processed during a live interaction. And this pattern is often disturbed in is affected.
Sorry,
conditions in pathologies where social functioning. So from the ontological viewpoint, famous work during the 90s have demonstrated that human children are able to automatically infer mental states on the basis of others' eye direction. So an example here, when you ask to the child which candidates shall he prefer, from the age of 4, he spontaneously designates the polo to respond to the question. And here a second example, if you show this photograph to children and ask to the child what is Sandy doing, from the age of 4, they respond that she's looking something at mind or thinking about something instead of responding that she's looking upward. So based on such observations, several authors started to study the development of gaze processing in human infants and converged toward a similar model of the development of social aptitudes in humans, relying on the development of gaze processing. So according to this model, as soon as birth, human would be able to discriminate eye direction, determining whether others either are directed toward themselves or toward the surrounding environment. And from 6 months of age, they will develop a very important mechanism, which is a reflexive mechanism called joint attention. So they become able to automatically follow others' eye direction toward the surrounding space, but without the awareness of the other's attention or intention. Such awareness would emerge around 9 months of age. At this stage, the infants become able to use her own gaze to incite others to look at the object of her attention. These three stages would be prerequisites to develop the premises of theory of mind, which is the ability to attribute mental states to other people. And indeed, a recent study using eye tracking in human infants demonstrates that such premises emerge around 15 months of age. Thus, understanding the processes involved in gaze perception will be very important to characterizing understanding the basis of social cognition and characterizing the pathology where social cognition is affected. And before approaching the brain basis of gaze processing, I just propose a brief interlude on the electroencephalography techniques. So electroencephalography consists in recording the brain activity of neurons population on the scalp. It is totally non-invasive. But in the raw signal you recorded, this raw signal is not very informative at the cognitive level because it is very noised and you may only observe very coarse events such as an epileptic crisis, for example, which which corresponds to a storm in the brain. So if you wish to study the response to a particular stimulus, for example, the response, the brain response to face perception, we usually present dozens of faces to the participants, and we average the brain activity recorded at each trial. So this allowed to eliminate all the parasites, all the noise produced by other activity. For example, here, the subject may have things about something else, and so on. You eliminate those parasites, and you isolate the response specific to the face. So you obtain a series of negative and positive waves called evoked potentials. And typically, when the participants process face, you observe a specific wave, a negative wave that culminates around 170 milliseconds, which is called the N170. As you can see here, the topography of this wave is very bilateral and culminates over temporal seats. And when you present other visual objects, the wave is much more occipital here and culminates before around 150 milliseconds. So this N170 is considered as a marker of face processing in human cognition. At the beginning of the 21st century, it has been proposed that the N170 could be a marker of gaze processing before becoming a marker of face processing during development. So this has been supported, for example, by this study. So for example, in this study, they show that the N170 was delayed and increased when you present isolated eyes to the participants instead of whole faces. And another nice developmental study. Here they presented several visual stimuli to different populations with different ages. So they presented whole faces, isolated eyes, inverted faces, scrambled faces, which means that the features have been mixed up, and also flowers. So they were presented to children from 4 years of age, 6 years of age, young adolescents of 12 years of age, and young adults. And we can observe that the only N170 that is structured and observable as soon as 4 years of age is the N170 in response to the isolated eyes here. All other N170 need several years to be structured and reach their maximal response. Among all gaze direction, some authors defend the view that those that look at the participants, those that display direct gaze and create eye contact with the participant, facial. And the human brain may be equipped with a specific mechanism devoted to process eye contact. This is supported, for example, by this study. The authors showed faces with direct gaze or with averted gaze to newborns. And they show that the newborns looked at longer and more often at the faces displaying direct gaze. This effect was very consistent, as you can see. Here, they calculated the bias of exploration, which could vary between minus one in this case, the bias is toward averted faces, or plus one, and in this case, the bias is toward faces with direct gaze. So each triangle represents one child, one newborn. So you may observe that a great majority of newborn present the bias toward the direct gaze. So now, usually, people made a clear distinction between the process related to direct gaze and the process related to averted gaze, with mainly the idea that direct gaze should involve emotional mechanism. This is indeed supported by fMRI studies showing that the emotional brain, for example, amygdala, orbitofrontal cortex, and anterior cingulate cortex are activated during the perception of a direct gaze. And in the other hand, averted gaze is associated with special mechanism and is underlined by a brain area involved in special attention. Yet this viewpoint is very simplistic. And when you study the mechanism involved in gaze processing, you observed that the brain bases vary substantially as a function of the context in which the gaze is processed. And I will illustrate this statement through several studies focusing on the N170. So as I said, the human brain may be equipped with specific mechanisms devoted to process direct gaze. So an intuitive hypothesis could be that the N170 is a marker of direct gaze processing before becoming a marker of gaze processing and then of face processing. If it is true, we should observe a delayed and increase N170 in response to direct gaze as compared to averted gaze. So we tested this hypothesis in this study. We presented faces one by one to the participants, and the participants knew that the gaze was moving either toward him, her, like the example of the left toward you, or the example of the right, the gaze could move away from the viewer. So here, the participants had to determine whether the gaze was orienting toward him, her, or toward someone else. Station, which could be deviated, like there, or...
If you're going to show it moving, can you first show it and then talk? Because they can't.
Sorry. So the direct gaze condition, and the averted gaze condition on the right. Okay. So the head could be deviated or frontal. The N170 in response to the different conditions. And as expected, the N170 was delayed and greater for the direct gaze conditions here, in orange and red. Whatever the head orientation as compared to the averted gaze condition in green. So here we use source reconstruction to estimate the brain sources that underlined this modulation using mathematical models, identify the emotional brain as responsive of this modulation. We identify here a network of regions that are known to be involved in theory of mind process. So more recently, a research group from US asked us to reproduce the experiment, but by adding a second task. So the initial task, does the gaze orient toward you or toward someone else, was identified as a social task. Thus, in other block of presentation, we proposed a non-social task, The participants had to determine in these blocks whether the gaze was orienting to the right or to the left. So here, the pattern of result is reverse. In the social task, which was the initial task, we reproduce our effects. Direct gaze induced a greater N170 as compared to averted gaze. But in the non-social task, the pattern is reversed. The averted gaze yields the greater N170. The task rendering the averted gaze more. Okay, now we used the same paradigm with an actor moving, but this time. but this time, several non-social cues may change in the scene. So the actor will change the gaze direction, the gesture, and the facial expression. So here an example where the three cues have. Okay. And mental conditions. The actor may move toward the participant here or away from him. And at each trial, only one cue or two cues or the three cues may change. So only one cue here, gaze orientation. Two cues, gaze orientation and gesture. Or gaze orientation and facial expression. And here the three cues. So what about the N170 in this context? First, we observe an increase of the N170 for the expression of hunger as compared to the neutral expression here. And this experiment has been recording under fMRI that allowed us to estimate the source of the modulation. So according to the fMRI, the source of the modulation here is the amygdala, which is well known for its role in emotional processing. Regarding the direct gaze condition, here the effects were complicated by an interaction with the gesture, the pointing gesture. So the result was intuitive because the condition where the actor point toward the participants and look at the participants, this condition yield a greater N170 as compared to all the other one. But once again, this modulation was not supported by the emotional brain. Here we identify two regions, somatosensory regions and the supplementary motor area, which are known to be involved in the representation of others' action. let us go a step further in this story. So in this study, we also observed another evoked potential, which culminates at 200 milliseconds on frontal seats here. It is called the P2. And here the P2 is represented for all the averted gaze conditions. This P2 here was not modulated by those conditions. But interestingly, in the direct gaze conditions, the wave increased with the number of social cues that were directed towards the participants. So here is the P2 for one social cues, only gaze. 2 social cues and 3 social cues. So such activity here, such increase of activity is expected to reflect the appraisal of the self-relevance of the visual scene. And according to the literature, such process should be underlined by the activity of the amygdala. But the fMRI here revealed that this activity was in fact subtended by a premotor region, which is involved in action preparation. Okay, so the brain mechanism underlying guest processing remain to be resolved. As I try to demonstrate it, the context change substantially the mechanism. Yet, at the behavioral level, the eye contact is known to impact cognition and behavior. Those effects are quite robust. They have been reproduced several times, particularly in young adults. And I would focus on 2 of them and then sum up the different effects that have been revealed in the literatures. So the first one is the attentional capture by direct gaze. As I told you, the human brain should be equipped with mechanisms devoted to detect direct gaze in the environment. So it is intuitive to think that people may automatically detect a direct gaze in the environment, even the adults. So in experimental psychology, when you wish to determine whether a stimulus is automatically detected, you usually use the visual search paradigm. Participants are asked to detect a target among distractors. So for example, if I ask you, where is the face of the animal? Okay, are you ready? The face of the animal. Did you find it? It is there on the right. Okay. Well, and now, please, where is in the next trial the face of the human? Yeah. So usually people are faster to detect human face than all other visual objects. So typically, the human face is automatically detected in human cognition, and this is reflected by this pattern of reaction time. Here, the reaction time are very fast, whatever the number of distractors. This pattern of activity of reaction time is called the pop-out effect. The face pops out of human cognition. When you search for another visual target, your reaction time increase with the number of distractors because you need to scan all the display to find the targets. So, several authors thought that direct gaze should pop out of human cognition. But we all failed to find such an effect.
Can you say that
again? Failed. We all failed to find the pop-out effect of direct gaze. Yet all these studies show that asparagus is indeed prioritized in human cognition and is detected faster than averted gaze. So for example, here the participants had to detect a direct gaze among averted gaze, or the reverse, an averted gaze among direct gaze. So we manipulated the number of distractors, which is the aim of the visual search paradigm. We also manipulated the head orientation. Here it is deviated, and here it was frontal. And finally, we manipulated the side of the target appearance. On the left, here on the left, and here, for example, on the right. Here are represented the reaction time when the participants have to detect the averted gaze target. So you may observe that number of distractors. But they're also dependent on the other contextual factors. They vary as a function of the head orientation and as a function of the visual field of appearance. Here are the reaction time for the direct gaze condition. So the reaction time increases also with the number of distractors. The direct gaze is not associated with the pop-out effect. Yet the direct gaze is detected more rapidly than the averted gaze. And this is because it does not depend on the other contextual factors. Another way to study whether a stimulus is automatically processed is to use this stimulus as a distractor for an unrelated task. So we tested this hypothesis using a very famous task, which is the Stroop task. So probably you know that the Stroop task consists in determining in which ink color a word is written. And the task is much more difficult to perform if the word designates a mismatching color. So the reaction time for this incongruent condition are much slower than the reaction time in a neutral condition, for example, a series of X. Add a gaze above. And the participants were informed that the gaze was not informative for the task and should be ignored. And the participants had to focus on the ink color and to perform the task as rapidly as possible. Despite this instruction, we observed the supplementary interference effect here in the direct gaze condition as compared to the closed eye condition. And if you replace the direct gaze by an averted gaze, here in another group of participants, the effect disappeared. So the presence of a direct gaze seems to capture cognitive resources in young adults. Another effect that has been mainly discovered by my research group is the effect of direct gaze on interoceptive awareness. So several authors have suggested that eye contact should trigger increased sense of the self or even boost self-awareness in infants. But such an effect have never been investigated experimentally. So here we wished to test whether direct gaze may enhance self-awareness, and we focused on interoceptive awareness, bodily self-awareness, which is theorized to be a basic form of self-awareness. So here the participants were confronted with emotional images. And for each of them, they have to rate the intensity of their bodily reactions. And concomitantly, we recorded the skin conductance response of the participants, which is known to reflect the intensity of emotional reaction.
What is the
skin conductance response? It's a response, an emotional, attentional response that depends on the sudation. Sweat.
Right.
Transpiration. So here the purpose was to calculate the correlation between the objective measure of bodily reactions and the subjective measure of the bodily reaction. So the greater the correlation, the more the participant is considered to be aware of his bodily reactions. And in this experiment, we manipulated the context in which the task was performed. So thus, each trial was initiated either by a fixation cross or by a face looking away, or a face with a direct gaze. And unexpected, we show that at mean, the mean of correlations of each subject were greater in the direct gaze condition as compared to the other two conditions. So my research group has developed several work on this, using this task to better understand this process. However, I have not the time to present all these studies, so I will present just one of them, the most recent one. We wish to test whether the effect of eye contact on self-awareness could be reproduced in other social, other sensory modalities. So the social contact may be created using different modalities, tactile, auditory modalities, and we tested whether we reproduce this effect of auditory and tactile modalities on self-awareness. So in the first experiment, we change the context and here, each trial was primed either by hearing one's own name, hearing the name of someone else, or hearing just noise. And in the second experiment, the trial was primed by a human touch on the forearm, a brush touch, sorry, here, or no touch at all. And indeed, we reproduced the results. That means the correlation were better in the condition of social contacts here, hearing someone calling out of our name or being touched by someone else. Because as I told you, there are other effects that have been found in the literature. It is only, I think, half of my talk. Sorry, so I'm going to just finish with this this model. So we recently proposed, I have not the time to go into details, but the idea is that when Darragues capture attention, he automatically activates the belief of being watched by someone else and triggers self-focused attention. So the attention will be focused on the self and lead to four types of effects, which are the eye contact effects per se. So I present you some data demonstrating the effect of self-awareness. But eye contact is also known to promote memory for faces, but also memory for discourses, for instructions, potentially for all information that become relevant, self-relevant, by the presence of the direct gaze. Interestingly, when you put eyes that are just drawn or even very schematic representation of files in the environment, you may observe the activation of prosocial actions in individuals. So for example, individuals become less likely to steal, more likely to share resources, and so on. And the last effect is the positive appraisal of others, which is very robust and new since the 70s. We evaluate people more positively when they look at us. So unfortunately, I do not have the time to continue, but I think that the challenge today, the literature has found robust effect of direct gaze, and as I demonstrated to you, this effect is mostly positive in human cognition. So the question is now how we could use this effect to develop, for example, diagnosing tool or tool of remediation that may serve in some pathologies. So we started this program in research in my group. I had some data to show you. Sorry. Thank you very much.
So first of all, I would like to thank you for having invited me. And second of all, I would like to apologize in advance for my strong French accents, and I hope this won't interfere with the translation. So we are going to talk about the sensory motor anchoring of perspective taking. So in other words, how those our muscles or whole body can support all social cognitive abilities. But first of all, we need to define what is perspective taking, because we all come from different scientific fields. It is probable that we all have different definitions. So, as a particular social species, humans benefit from a whole range of abilities in order to interact efficiently with their congeners. And this is called social cognition. And among these abilities, there are some abilities like face and body perceptions, gaze detections, imitations, but also maybe more complex forms such as theory of mind, empathy, or perspective taking. And very honestly, I'm not making a big difference between these three terms because of the very important mess that exists in the literature. And here you got three recent definitions by important persons in those respective fields. And you can see that we get exactly the same idea in the three definitions. So perspective taking is actively entertaining other people's mental states, such as their thoughts or feelings and other experience. Theory of mind is knowing another person's internal state, including his or her thoughts and feelings. And empathy refers to the ability to attribute mental states, such as emotion, intentions, or beliefs, to other persons. So that's basically the same idea. And in the sake of clarity, I will just speak of perspective taking as the ability to represent another person's internal states. And the choice of this concept compared to the two other concepts is moreover motivated by the fact that we can modulate it in order to speak of specific aspects of perspective taking. For example, cognitive perspective taking could refer to the ability to represent another person's cognition. Emotional perspective taking as the ability to represent another person's emotion. Perceptual perspective taking as the ability to represent another person's perceptions. And there are basically no limits that can be made with this type of use. We can speak about intentional perspective taking, or visual perspective taking, and auditory perspective taking, and so on. So I believe it's probably the simplest way to discuss this phenomenon. And in the literature, the three most the domains that have been the most investigated are those of cognition, emotions, and in developmental psychology, a little about perceptions, but most of the tests that we use today in order to examine patients, for example, in clinical population, comes from the fields of cognitive perspective taking or emotional perspective taking. So the aim of this talk is to see how sensorimotor processes may allow us to infer others' emotions, other perceptions, or other intentions, or in other words, how our body help us to understand our congener. I will only spend some minutes on emotional perspective taking for two reasons. The first is that I'm not a direct expert on this question, and the second is that it's easy to conceive, because emotion necessary implied action. So you cannot have emotion without action. When you express joy, you show your teeth, you open your eyes, and that's not typical from humans, but for a whole bunch of animals. You can see this pattern also for scared person, surprised person here, and scared person here. And we emotion is by default recruiting a lot of motion. And from the pure visual experience, we are able to identify the emotions of the person. This is a classical test that we can use in clinical settings, where you have different labels. Like joy, surprise, sadness, fear, disgust, anger. And we are all able to accurately identify the expressions. But what's interesting here is that emotions not only involved motor action at the first person perspective, but also when you interpret the emotions of other person, you are using your own motor systems. It has been widely shown that we spontaneously mimic others' emotional faces. That is, the simple fact of seeing an emotion in other persons leads to the same motor activation in our body in response. And this, even when we don't explicitly perceive them. It has been shown, for example, even when the emotional face is presented only 30 milliseconds, which is out of our consciousness. So we still mimic, even when we're not conscious. And as a supplemental proof, it has been shown that interfering with this automatic motor contagion of the face interfere with our ability to infer others' emotional states. For example, in a study, there's authors who ask their participants to hold a pen between their teeth, like this. And because it prevents participants to mimic with their zygomatic, it decreases participants' performance in an emotion recognition task. Yeah, they have the pen, and they, their performance decreases. They were not as able as in a control condition to identify the face, the emotion of the face. It has been also investigated in a group of patients that just had a Botox injection. And the same results have been observed, that is, you are, your performance in identifying others' emotions decrease after your Botox injection. And last but not least, the use of pacifier during childhood also interfere with our abilities to identify others' emotions. But pacifiers... But only for the use during days, because during night you don't associate, you don't mimic, so there's no risk to use pacifier during the night. And that's all that I will say about emotional perspective taking. It seems there's a lot of evidence that by mimicking others' facial expressions that we can access to their emotional states, and that's The second point will concern perceptual perspective taking. And in particular, we will focus here on visual perspective taking, because most, if not all, the studies on perceptual perspective taking focuses on the visual sense. And there's two kinds of visual spatial perspective taking. This is the first level, and it corresponds to represent what can be seen by another person. And for example, if here you have another person, you are there, and you can figure that he can see the flower, which is here, but not the bag, because the bag is hidden by the tree from his point of view. That's level one, perspective taking. And this is supposed to be automatic and widespread in the animal kingdom. And it has been proposed that to perform level one, visual spatial perspective taking, we compute the line of sight between the other agents and the objects. Like this, or this. And if there's something that interrupts the mental line between the gaze of the person and the object, then we deduce, we conclude that the object cannot be seen by the person. And when we imagine mental line, it is the same process that as we draw line, actually draw line with our arm, for example. And the most, the journey, I don't know if you can say this, the longer the line is, the longer time, the more we will need time. This has been shown, for example, in this kind of experiments. Participants were presented on a screen with the type of scene, with a doll here and a lot of objects all around the table. They have a cue on the top. Here is a pencil, and they have to detect if the object, which is here, can be or cannot be seen by the doll. And the object could be far from the doll or close to the doll. And what has been observed is like when the object is close, near to the doll, participants are far fastest, have shortest reaction time to detect that the doll can see the object than when the object is far from the doll, supporting the idea that we mentally compute a line. Concerning level 2 motor visual, visuomotor spatial perspective taking, which refers to how does he or she perceive this scene, not only can he see the objects, but how does the objects appear to him? For example, here, so you're still there, here's still your friend, and here you can say that from his point of view, the flower is at the right of the tree. You not only, is it clear, the difference? Yeah. Okay. And concerning this type of perspective taking, it is considered that we put ourselves in the shoes of the other person. And we mentally rotate in order to adjust our posture with the posture of the other person. And it has been several works support this interpretation. For example, a study by the same group of authors showed that participants were presented with different visual scenes that can be aligned with the point of view of participants or shifted 90 degrees to the left or to the right, or the doll could face the participants. And there are also other angles. And participants had to categorize if the object was at the right or at the left of the doll for the different angles. And what is observed is that the more the angular discrepancy between the avatar, the doll, and the participants is important, and the more participants needed time to respond to the question. Supporting then that we rotate in order to align our body with the body of the other person. And the angular discrepancy, the more time you will need. We perform also that kind of experiments in our lab, where we ask participants to guide a small character here among in a labyrinth, in a maze. So they just have to say left, right, left, right, right, left, right, and things like this to guide the character among the labyrinths, among the maze. But they can do this at the first person perspective, from their point of view, which is really relatively easy, or at the second person's perspective, the character starting from that point, and they have to guide the character from the opposite point of view, which is way more difficult. I can show you two videos And you could see that participants recruit their own body to deduce the direction that the character should follow. Okay, that's the first-person perspective. So she is probably saying right, left, right, left, right, left. Okay, now that's the second-person perspective, which imply to put ourselves in the shoes of the other person. And you can see this with just your eyes, but we are performing kinematics analysis in order to quantify. So waiting for the kinematics analysis, we have conducted another study where we prevent participants to move. So they also had to guide that little character in the lab, in the maze. And there are three conditions. So first-person perspective, that's what you just seen. Second-person perspective, so the character starts from the other parts of the maze. Or second-person perspective, but with motor interference, and participants at their back are stuck against the chair and their arm in their back. And here you can see the proportion of errors in the three conditions. And the task is pretty easy at the first-person perspective. Participants don't commit mistakes. At the second-person perspective, it's a little difficult, but they still don't produce that much mistakes. And when we interfere with their body, when we prevent them from moving their shoulder, we have something like around 10% of error. Okay, I try to do all my... my talk. That's another study where we ask ourselves if we reverse our motor strategies, if we imagine ourselves on the other side of the table. If I put myself in the shoes of the partner, will I start to read from right to left, in other words? Because I imagine myself at the other side of on the other side of the table. So participants perform the naming task where they just have to name the objects that were displayed on a big tactile screen. And there was three conditions. So the first condition, instruction was, what do you see? Please name all the objects you can see. The second instruction was, what do I see? And there was the experimenter there, please name all the objects I can see. And the third condition was, it was a control. What do I see? Please name all the objects I can see. But this time, the experimenter was on the same time as the participants. Okay. What we observed is, here is the evolution of the mean location of the objects named on the y-axis. That is, it corresponds to this axis, the y-axis. And what we observe is that at the first-person perspective, that is, when participants respond to the instruction, what do you see? They started to name the objects that directly surrounded them. So they start with the objects that they can grasp. And then they progressively named objects that are farther from them. At the second-person perspective, when they speak for the experimenter, which is on the other side of the table, they start to name the objects that are directly reachable for the experimenter, as if they actually project themselves in the sex, in the body of the experimenter. And there's an in-between pattern when the experimenter is on the same side of the participant, as the participants. Concerning the x-axis, which was clearly unexpected, but still there, is that even when participants and experimenters were on the same size, we observed an effect, but this time on the x-axis. That is, when the experimenter was seated at the left of participants, participants started to name the objects that were at their left. And when the experimenter was seated right to the participants, participants begin to name the objects that was at the right of the table, as if, again, they were projecting themselves, even if they show, they share the same point of view. We then decided to put a more critical test to our interpretation. And we tried this type of task with patients that suffer from spatial hemineglects. I'm not sure you're all familiar with that syndrome. Okay, so spatial hemineglect is a neurological syndrome classically observed following stroke, and in which participants neglect half of their visual hemifield. So they shave only half of their face, they eat only half of the plates. When they have to copy a drawing, they copy only half of the drawing. When they have to color a drawing, they color only half the drawing. Here you have a dog suffering from spatial hemineglect, who lick again and again and again the same side of his plate. Once I've seen a patient who were only wearing the right legs of his trousers and walking like this. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so our hypothesis was that, okay, if the patient actually put itself in myself, project his body into my body, we could reverse his spatial neglect. So that was the settings. We put a big plate with a lot of objects just in face of the patients. And we ask him to, at the first-person perspective, to describe all the objects he can see. And at the second-person perspective, to describe all the objects the experimenter can see. What we observed at the first-person perspective, so we are three different conditions with more and more objects. What we observed is that participants omitted some objects that classical in this type of syndrome, but they typically omitted way more objects on the left side than on the right side. Here, there's only one omission, and it's on the left side. Here, half of the omission in the left side, and here, only one object detected on the left side.
One object detected?
Yeah. Yeah. At the second person perspective, and at the second person perspective, we observe then no more omission on the easy trial. A single omission, but this time on the right, on the medium trial. And an increase of the proportion of object detected on the left, and a decrease of the proportion of objects detected on the right for the difficult trial. Here you have the bias when we compute the proportion of objects on the left that has been detected. When we divide the proportion of objects that were on the left and that has been detected by the proportion of objects that were situated on the right. So when the bias is inferior to one, that translates a bias to the right. So our patients actually suffer for hemispatial neglect. And when the bias is superior to 1, then it's reveal a bias to the left. And at the second person perspective, we can see that here there's no more bias. Here, participants started to neglect the left, the right side of space, and here he clearly compensates his initial neglects. Last thing on this point is the trajectory of his exploration. And as control participants, as in the previous experiments, we can see that participants always start with objects close to him, here. So close to him and at the middle of the table. Then he go farther and farther and systematically turn to the right because he neglects the left space. So he turns to the right, goes up and turns to the right. And at the second person perspective, even if you were seated exactly at the same place, we observed a reverse pattern. That is, it started with objects on the other side of the table, go closer and closer, and then turn to the left. And the same pattern here started on the other side of the table, go closer and closer to him, and shift to the left. And again here, it started from the other side of the table, go closer and closer to him, and then shift to the left. So, and here you have a graphical illustration of these effects with the mean trajectories for all the trial, and we can observe the same pattern as with control participants in the previous experiments. That was all I wanted to say about the perceptual perspective taking, which seems to involve the whole body representation to figure how others can see the environments. But because of the question this morning, I had two slides in order to discuss the effects of the cultural effects on visual spatial perspective taking. We've recently conducted an international studies with 100 on French French participants and hundreds of Japanese participants, which are known for be more collectivist country or participants. I don't know how to say this. And we just present them the photo, this kind of photo or photograph. But we also control to put Japanese or to put women. We tried a lot of actors, in fact. And participants were just displayed this kind of photograph and asked, in relation to the bottle, where is the book? And in fact, this allows us to test what perspective will spontaneously be endorsed for when responding. According to me, if I'm facing the photograph, I will answer to the right. But if I project myself in the shoes of that guy, I could answer to the left. Or it is even possible to say on the same table. That will be an allocentric point of view. And what we observed is that French participants are clearly egocentric, with around 70% of participants who keep their own perspective when responding to that question. And around 20-25% of participants who take the actor's perspective. But Japanese participants are way more egocentric, around 35% of Japanese endorse. Way less egocentric, with only around 35% of participants that endorse an egocentric point of view, and they more rely, it does not differ on the tendency to endorse the actor's point of view, but where it differs is on the tendency to use an allocentered perspective, that is to describe the objects in relation to the others, but not with a human-centered point of view.
Yeah. No one say that the book is in face to the bottle.
Yeah, but that was interpreted as a neutral response because it only involved the objects.
So no one said that? Yeah,
maybe, I don't know, 1% of participants.
Okay. Was the picture exactly the same for a Western person?
Yeah.
Or also for Japanese?
Yeah. Okay. We had these pictures, but with different actors.
So no Japanese person, but you also for?
Or a Japanese person, but in the same context.
So the answer is yes. We're different people on the...
So for the Japanese, there was a Japanese person, and for the French... So
we tried old. We tried older.
Yeah,
that's the in-group old group there.
That was relevant to the grade version.
Yeah.
In-group R2, okay.
So, yeah.
Did some people ask, do you ask me in my perspective or in his perspective?
It was a questionnaire, they just had to fill, so they cannot ask us. But some participants, but not a lot, something like 5%, maybe less, specify two perspectives. Like to the right, according to me, but to the left for the actor. But less than 5%.
I have a question.
Okay.
Very short question, but I'll come up. Can you all see me?
Okay.
You're looking at the French and Japanese cultures, and I have a question. Have you had any deaf people in your study?
Huh.
Because I think their vocational is a very different. As a sign language user, if I see something in front of me, the map, what we'll do, we'll say Germany is on the left and the other one's on the right. We will take the other person's perspective automatically because that's within our language. So that would be really, really interesting. If you ever do this again, please add a group of sign language user deaf people, and I would like to see what the
would be. But I will be happy to perform that kind of study with people from your lab, specialists in sign language. That's an excellent idea. Okay, so we will go really quickly on intentional perspective taking because we are running out of time. So, it is known for a long time that we can anticipate others' motor intention. That is, if you're at the restaurant with your dates, and that person grasps for a glass of water, you can anticipate from body movements if she grasps the glass of water in order to drink from it or in order to throw it at your face. And it has been shown already several decades ago in an experiment where participants were asked to grasp for an object in order to throw it or in order to place it in a small container. But they always started from the same starting position, and the object was always placed at the same location. So the first movements should be the same. Only the finality of the movement differs. And what we observed is that already the first movement is influenced by the intention of the person. Here you have... Here you have the duration of the movement that has been normalized in order to compare all the trajectory. And here you have the velocity of the wrist of participants. Here, it's the typical curves for... and maybe it needs some explanation. So at the beginning of the trial, your velocity is equal to zero because you're standing. Then you increase. That's the top, the maximum of your velocity. Then you decrease in order to be precise enough to grasp the objects. And every human movement follows this kind of velocity profile. So here are the curves for the placing intention and here for the throwing intention. And what we can see is that, first of all, the maximum, the peak of velocity is higher when wanting to throw the objects, other than when wanting to place the objects. Second, when wanting to place the objects, you can see that the moment at which the peak occurs is earlier than for the throwing. And what does it mean is that for the placing action, you have a longer deceleration phase, which allows you to be more precise. That is, as the final goal, the anticipated intentions influence your movement from the very beginning, already in previous action. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I cannot answer for that experiment, but we can easily anticipate that it will be in between these two group of curves. Yeah. In fact, there's tons of experiments that tested lots of actions, and the more you have to be precise, longer is your deceleration phase. And the more you have to be strong, I don't know how to say this, the shorter is your deceleration phase. And it has been shown also for a long time that when you present video of such movements to naive participants and ask them to categorize the video, participants are quite accurate to categorize the video, even if they are not aware that they can. They generally say, okay, I've just responded completely randomly, you will discard my data, but classically we get 70 or 80% of correct response. And in fact, we can observe this type of abilities in everyday life. When we shake others' hand, we are anticipating others' intentions. Otherwise, we should wait until our congenial movements is ended, in order to start all movements. But we classically started a movement at the same time, and we are doing great. Okay, you have 5 minutes? Six. Okay. Okay. A classical idea was that if we can anticipate motor intention, because they have different motor consequences, to be fast or to be precise or things like this, we cannot anticipate private intentions, because the same actions could serve different purposes. For example, I can put a glass on the table in order to drink 1 hour after, or in order to allow a partner to drink. But that would be, this time, the same action with the same motor constraints. So for a long time, it has been conceived that we can anticipate others' motor intention, but certainly not others' private intention. That is the meaning that governs this action. And we performed a series of experiments in which we tried to demonstrate that it is possible, in fact, to interpret others' private intention. So participants played a game interaction, and one of the participants was called the actor, the other the partner, but they were not aware that they were that's just labeled in order to discuss today. In the experiments, there was two naive participants. And according to sounds that were broadcast in the experimental box, participants performed different actions. On the first sound, the first sound triggers a preparatory action, which was always performed by the actor and consisted in placing the objects, a little dowel, on the central location. It was believed to be irrelevant to the experiment, but just needed in order to play for the critical trial. Then occurred the main action, which could be performed either by the actor or by the partner, depending on the sound that was displayed. And finally, a last sound triggers the repositioning action, allowing us to start a new trial. And so only this part of a trial could be performed by the two participants. And participants were asked to earn some points if they were quick enough and accurate enough when performing this action. And the trick was that what in fact interested us was the preparatory action, the action was which had no relevance for the task. But because sometimes given to, in different experiments, given to Q or given to experimental settings, the actors could anticipate who will perform the next action. Okay. He could sometimes place the well for himself or sometimes for his partner, even if the action to be performed was always the same. And what we observed is that when we performed an action with a social intention, that is for another person, we tend to exaggerate the spatial and the temporal parameters of our action. So, we tend to have longer reaction time, a longer duration of the movements, and a higher trajectories. That is, we basically exaggerate the spatial and the temporal parameters of our actions. And it is congruent with a lot of... Combien j'ai de temps, là? Une minute? Ouais. Okay. Moi, je vais m'arrêter là, alors. It is, in fact... Oh non, c'est pas très intéressant. Okay, just and that I will finish with this slide. And we then tested naive participants. We did not participated in the previous experiments, and displayed them short movie, like 1 second movie of reaching arm movements, and asked them to classify the video. With two key response key, and they just had after a short movie to discriminate. Okay, this was a social movement or this was a personal movement. Again, all participants. I will show you some example. You can try if you want to. Okay, so in principle, that should be difficult. Because that's really, you would say, personal, social? Social, personal? I believe that it is personal, social, but I should check, because honestly, it's really difficult, and I've tested myself, and I like the worst of all the participants. And what we observe is that we repeated this task in a lot of settings with eye tracking, with EEG, or with just behavioral tasks, and we always get the same percentage of correct answers, which is around between 60 and 65 correct response, which is higher than the that what can be randomly expected, because we have two conditions that should be 50%. And you can see here are the participants from our eye-tracking study. And you can see here that most of the participants, nearly two-thirds or two-thirds, are actually over the random value. Only here, three, four, five, maybe five participants respond completely at random. And what is really interesting is that there's also participants that are worse than the random value. That is, they apply a rule, they are able to discriminate the video, but they apply the wrong rule. And it's kind of normal, in fact, because we all know persons who are pretty bad in social interactions, and we can detect that something has been sent but interpreted completely in the wrong way. So yeah, I will conclude on this. It seems then that we are able to infer others' intention from their movements. So we can, with the aid of our body, represent others' emotions, others' visual spatial perceptions, but also others' intentions. And I would thank you for your attention, and thanks all the co-workers who contributed in the study I've presented to you. Thank you.